On this week's 51%, we speak with attorney Heather Lothrop of the Urban Justice Center about what immigrant survivors of domestic violence should know as they're planning to leave an abusive partner or bring them to court.
In a scenario where the partner is more familiar with the laws in the U.S., then the survivor may believe, even falsely, what that partner is telling them.
We also learn about a bill in Congress that would expand childcare options for police officers. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on. I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Lita. I wasn't really in it. I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Last week, we spoke with Shawnee Adess of the New York Legal Assistance Group about what survivors of domestic violence should know if they're seeking a divorce, restraining order, custody, child support, or other types of legal relief from their abuser. And we touched briefly on how that advice might apply to immigrant survivors of domestic violence, but there are added layers that immigrant survivors may need to keep in mind as they go through the courts, especially as the Trump administration works to ramp up deportations nationwide. Our main guest today leads the family law and immigration law teams at the Urban Justice Center's Domestic Violence Project. Attorney Heather Lothrop has been representing survivors of domestic violence since 2014 and also gives trainings to government and social service offices about emerging issues in family law. Just a heads up to our listeners that our conversation, of course, touches on domestic violence. If you or someone you love has been impacted, please know that help is available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is available 24/7 by calling 1-800-799-SAFE or by texting START to 88788. You can also chat online at thehotline.org.
What I want people to know when they come to me is that they are the expert in their own lives. They have been living their life. They have survived what they've been through, and they have gotten this far. And I want the survivors to be able to get information and to learn about risks and benefits or pros and cons, to learn about the systems that they will be navigating, but ultimately to feel that they are able to make the decisions that are best for them, for their own lives. I think that is where survivors will be the most successful, if they can make decisions that will actually work for them in their own lives.
If you're an immigrant and a survivor of domestic violence, I imagine there's a whole other layer of things you might experience or that you have to keep in mind when you take legal action. I guess, what have you noticed in your work with immigrant survivors?
There are several things. One can be a language barrier. So many immigrants are not native English speakers. And so then finding out information can be really difficult. Look at our court system website, for instance. It's entirely in English. So unless you are tech savvy enough to know how to translate that website, it's maybe not available for you to learn information. And so it's important that there are services provided in the languages that our clients speak so that they can access and real information about what they need to know about their options and about their cases. Immigrants might be unfamiliar with the U.S. laws and with these systems in the U.S. I've had clients who have been afraid to call the police because of experiences they've had in their home country with the police. And so they don't trust the police. They don't believe that the police are going to take them seriously or believe them. They may not be familiar with how custody or visitation works in the United States or divorce, because it may function differently in another country. And especially if the survivor is unfamiliar with the laws of the U.S., especially in a scenario where the partner is more familiar with the laws in the U.S., maybe they're a U.S. citizen or a legal permanent resident, then the survivor may believe, even falsely, what that partner is telling them, because they believe the partner has more understanding or more knowledge. And the partner is certainly projecting that they have more understanding and more knowledge of the system. And they can lie, right? They can say things like, if you leave me because of your status, the courts are going to grant me custody of the children, or I'm going to be able to take the children away from you, or you won't be able to get anything from me, or you won't be able to access these things. And even if those things are not true, then that is a way to intimidate and to threaten the survivor to stay. There's also the use of immigration status. So again, especially in a scenario where one partner has citizenship or lawful permanent residence and the survivor does not, the partner can use their status as a threat, as a way to coerce. They can, say, I'm going to call ICE on you. I'm not going to help you file the application that you need to file to get a green card. I'm not going to go to the interview that we need to go to in order for you to get status if you don't do what I say. And so these are ways of coercing the survivor into staying and also keeping them from getting access to things like a green card or a more permanent status.
What do you do in that case? What are your options?
There is something called a VAWA self-petition or a battered spouse waiver, and those are applications that the survivor can file so that they can get access to what they would have gotten access to had their partner not been abusive. So, in a marriage where one person is not abusive, you would expect that that partner would, if they could, file for their partner to get their green card and go to the appointments that are scheduled. The VAWA self-petition and the battered spouse waiver allows for survivors to petition on their own without their partner so that they can get that relief independently.
Obviously, it's a pretty precarious time to be an immigrant in the United States as the federal government is ramping up deportations, and across the board, it's also working to slash federal spending in some areas. Are you noticing these things impact your work at all or the success of these applications?
The success rate, I think, will depend a lot more on some of the other changes that the Trump administration is making in terms of how they adjudicate cases. But certainly, at a time where there is even more need for people to file applications or more people are being detained, yes, as federal funding is being cut, that is going to impact services and it's going to impact the number of cases that lawyers, not-for-profit lawyers, are able to take on pro bono. Even city and state funding, I think the reality is that if they are losing federal funding, are going to be able to direct fewer resources to this type of work. That will trickle down as well. That even at a time where people are in more need of these services and this assistance, there will just be fewer options available.
You mentioned some other changes that the administration has made. What are those?
Yeah, so it's probably easier to talk a little bit about what they did during the first Trump administration because so much is changing every day with this new administration. But they would do things like change how you had to fill out the forms. Another thing they've even done this time around is changed a version of the form such that now there's a new version that you have to use, and everything that you did up until then has to be redone. They can request evidence in cases. So once you file a case, they can come back and say, we need more answers to these things. And so they can sometimes change what types of things they are asking for in those requests for evidence. They can change some of those rules, especially in removal proceedings, to try to change how they are operating.
Are there types of documentation or records that you recommend survivors keep on hand for their cases?
Yeah, so it depends on what they're looking to do, but always good for people to have an ID. So in New York State, regardless of status, you can get a driver's license. So that is good for everybody to have. It is good for people to document their abuse if they can. So having that on hand can be very helpful. People lose their phones all the time. Things that were saved get lost. So having that backed up can be really important. having information if somebody has filed for immigration relief about any receipt notices that they've had or documentation around that can be really helpful. And also just documentation around cases can be helpful. What did you file? What were the outcomes of those cases? And so those are some things that can be very helpful. For certain filings, like we were talking about VAWA, it can be helpful to show proof that you live together. So mail that shows that you lived at the same address, joint accounts, photos of times that were happy to show that the marriage was real, providing statements from other people who knew you at the time and who could talk to what your relationship was like when they knew you.
What do you feel people maybe commonly misunderstand about working with survivors of domestic violence?
There's a few things that are important. One is to look holistically at the person before you. So it can be easy, I think, as an advocate to look at what the issues are presented before you and assess what you think is the most important. But focusing on what the survivor thinks is most important and letting them lead is crucial. They, again, are in the position to know what is best for them and in their own life. As part of being in an abusive relationship, the partner is often taking away the survivor's autonomy, right? They're taking away their ability to make decisions and to assess what is most important for them and assess what they should be doing, right? They will tell them, go here, don't go here, dress this way, don't talk to this person. Putting the survivor back in the driver's seat of their own life, letting them make the call, I think is really, really important. It also helps to establish and to build trust, which is something that takes a long time, or it can take a long time. I had, as an example, one client who came into my office and initially decided that he didn't want to talk to me and left. And he needed some time to think about whether or not he wanted to engage with me and to talk with me about his circumstances. And when he came back, I just said, okay, yep, we can talk. And allowing him that space and that time meant that when he came back, he was ready to talk to me. And in this particular case, he was most concerned about immigration needs. And so even though I was concerned as his advocate about physical safety, I met him where he was at. We've safety planned for him since he was still in his relationship and then focused on getting answers and talking through the immigration concerns so that once he felt safe on the immigration concerns, we then were able to shift to safety planning about leaving the relationship and ultimately getting him an order of protection, a divorce, successfully filing a VAWA petition. All the way through, this client is now a US citizen. But all of that took time that if the client hadn't been the one leading, I think there were multiple points where we could have lost that trust and not been able to achieve those outcomes.
Well, Heather, thank you so much for taking the time. Is there anything that we haven't touched on yet that you want people to know?
I would like to say also, in terms of there is so much fear and there is so much going on that doctors and hospitals are required to follow HIPAA laws. So I've heard of survivors who are maybe scared to access the healthcare system. And while it is a scary time, doctors and hospitals are not supposed to be disclosing immigration status. And so I would encourage people to attend to their health needs. Also, the courts in New York are protected under the Protector Courts Act. And so, again, while it can be scary to go to court and it can be scary going in and out of court, courts are not supposed to be places where ICE arrests people without a judicial warrant. And so I just wanted to say that so that people know that even if there are fears and they are scared, that some of these places are safer than maybe others. And that I don't want people to not get the services or the help that they need.
Heather Lothrup is the Director of Legal Services at the Urban Justice Center's Domestic Violence Project. You can learn more about her work at dvp.urbanjustice.org. And again, if you or someone you love has been impacted by domestic violence, help is available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is available 24/7 by calling 1-800-799-SAFE or by texting START to 88788. Its website is thehotline.org. U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand was recently in Poughkeepsie, New York, to tout a bill in Congress that she says would increase childcare options for police officers nationwide. The New York Democrat says the Providing Child Care for Police Officers Act would set aside $24 million for each of the next five fiscal years to encourage police departments to try their own pilot child care programs. Gillibrand says departments would receive grants of up to $3 million to either open their own child care programs, contract with local daycares, or provide child care scholarships to officers' families.
So if it's a big police department and there's 10 or 15 children, well, you might be able to open your own daycare center. If you're a police department that has two or three children that still need care, you might be able to partner with a local daycare center to open earlier. So one of the problems is that daycare centers are usually like 8 a.m. to 5:30 p.m., maybe 6 p.m. if you're lucky. But that's not when our law enforcement has their shifts.
Gillibrand says finding childcare as a police officer is often difficult, especially in the first few years on the job, when shifts can be long or unpredictable. She theorizes the struggle to balance work and family life is one of the many factors keeping potential candidates, especially women, from pursuing careers in law enforcement. A survey by the International Association of Chiefs of Police last year found 70% of agency heads nationwide say recruitment is more difficult today than it was 5 years ago. Poughkeepsie Police Chief Richard Wilson says his department of 92 officers currently has 11 vacancies. He cites a few reasons for the shortage. Namely, he says police departments in Dutchess County are competing for an overall smaller number of officers compared to areas like Albany or New York City. But on that front, he sees childcare as a major bargaining chip to help bring candidates into Poughkeepsie. Wilson has been with the department for more than 30 years. His wife is a New York State trooper, and he remembers how difficult it was for them to find childcare when their children were little.
The greatest source of anxiety and stress for us was how we were going to piecemeal together childcare. And that came together with a combination of parents, family, friends, and part-time childcare. Except that stress was compounded by the fact that we needed to secure that childcare by committing to full-time hours, facing conflicts in our scheduling and overtime. Anything that the government can do to release and reduce that anxiety on staff here will be a great benefit to our wellness, to our staff's wellness, and to how we're able to police our community.
It's not a given that Poughkeepsie would receive any grants, but Gillibrand says she's hopeful that the state's police departments would fare well in applications for the federal funds. 20% of the total grant funding would be set aside strictly for smaller police departments with less than 200 officers. The bill, which is co-sponsored by Republican North Carolina Senator Tom Tillis in the Senate and California Democrat Scott Peters in the House, has not been brought to a vote in either chamber. The bill comes at a time when the Trump administration is actively slashing federal spending for many social programs. But if it were to pass, Gillibrand says grants could start as soon as next year. Ultimately, she'd like to expand the idea to other emergency personnel down the line, from EMS crews to air traffic controllers.
If we were successful in getting this passed, you would amplify it for all public servants. We need more FAA workers. We need more every first responder. Like, there's not one in public service that is recruiting at full complement.
Lastly, New York has a new commissioner for its Office for People with Developmental Disabilities. Willow Bear previously served as the office's executive deputy commissioner and has provided legal counsel to New York Governor Kathy Hochul's office, as well as other state offices. As commissioner, she will lead a department that offers both direct service for people with developmental disabilities and guide a network of roughly 450 nonprofits. Bear recently spoke with Chantel Destra of the New York Public News Network about her plans for the role and about the 35th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which prohibits discrimination based on disability.
I want New York State to remain sort of a leader in the disability services world. I'm so proud of the work that we've done, but as a system, we are at like a midlife crisis. We're a relatively new system throughout the country in terms of having people with disabilities really community integrated, getting jobs, living their best life in the community. And I am really excited to move into the future, into the next wave of what the service system can look like to make sure people really are living the same life that anyone else has access to. So I'm really proud to be at the sort of helm of the next wave of that transformation.
And how do you think your tenure as commissioner will be different or unique to the tenures of those before you?
Well, that's a great question. I think everyone is different. Everyone brings a little something different. I really come to the system from the role of an advocate and as a family member. So I'm the family member of someone with a developmental disability served in the system. And so my focus right out of the gate was to make sure that we had family stakeholders and self-advocates at the table to help us develop policies and to really understand the customer experience of the service system. And so I think that sort of vision as an advocate is what I build into everything I do and hope to be sort of the lasting legacy of my leadership.
And July marks the 35th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. What does that milestone mean to you and your office?
It is, and thank you for highlighting it. It means everything. I was in Austria not that long ago at a conference filled with people that were disability advocates from all different countries all around the world. And the United States really is still the North Star in terms of disability access. And it's because of things like the ADA, which really we only have here. Many other countries don't even have an ADA yet. We're really excited to be celebrating that event in the plaza and to be focusing on what we have done in this state over the last 35 years. It is everything to the disability rights community and to our agency in particular. We want people with developmental disabilities to have access to anything you or I would have access to. And the ADA is really at the heart of everything.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you about the legacy of the Willowbrook State School. Now we know this was a state-owned facility that would house children with developmental disabilities. It was closed down after several reports of just neglect and deplorable conditions for the kids in the school. What does the legacy of Willowbrook mean to you, and how does that sort of shape the way that you're going to approach leadership?
The legacy of Willowbrook is hard for New York because it immediately conjures this image for anyone. You hear the words Willowbrook, you remember the documentary, you remember those images and those sounds, right? And it was awful. But the closing of Willowbrook really sparked an international movement, and that started here in New York, right? In terms of deinstitutionalizing people, moving them out of those horrible conditions, moving people out into community residences, taking people out to volunteer, right? And so that marked really the start of everything that my agency does, yeah. And is such a rich history, but such a dark history, right? This year and this year's enacted budget actually have an incredible investment from the governor and the legislature to build a Willowbrook Center for Learning in Staten Island, where we're renovating the last building left on that state campus that needs that renovation. It's still sort of stuck in time. It looks the same as it did then, and it's a terrible reminder when people drive past it. So we have this incredible investment to update the entire campus, to really make some modernizations, and in that building in particular, to build a Willowbrook Center for Learning, where we can bring artifacts and timelines and really honor that history in a positive way and really highlight how much growth has happened since then.
And if someone wanted to report neglect for a person with developmental disabilities today, is that something they could do with your office, or would it be another state agency like the Inspector General's office?
So the New York State Justice Center was launched in 2013, and all allegations of abuse, neglect, not just for my system, but for other systems that serve vulnerable populations in New York, the New York State Justice Center houses sort of that reporting process. Reports can be made to us directly. We make reports to the Justice Center when we need to, but they sort of maintain that process to make sure that everything is reported and reviewed from a neutral third party.
And when it comes to the work of your office, is there any overlap with the Council for Developmental Disabilities?
Absolutely. So our partners at the council really oversee the grant process. They have federal funding. They're in charge of the federal funding component of the Developmental Disability Service System, and they review grants and initiatives. And so we really work in partnership with them. They are their own agency. They have their own director. She does incredible work and brings a wealth of experience to this field. But they are incredible partners in terms of sharing their research, sharing their resources. We talk all the time about what my priorities are and how they can be of assistance and vice versa. So they're an incredible partner here in New York.
And you mentioned federal funding and federal policy, so I wanted to get into President Donald Trump's Big Beautiful Bill. Do you see that federal policy having any impact on the work that you're doing?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's no way it couldn't. Mm-hmm. So we know that the impact of that bill will look like almost $14 billion in Medicaid cuts to New York State. So that is largely in health and hospital systems, but you can't cut $14 billion of healthcare in New York State and not impact people with disabilities who also rely on Medicaid for those health services. People with developmental disabilities in particular already have a very hard time finding medical providers, dental providers, appointment times, offices that are wheelchair accessible, for example. Our population has a hard time accessing healthcare, and this will make it 100 times harder for them. We rely on $7 billion of Medicaid just to serve people with developmental disabilities in New York alone. So when you're looking at $14 billion overall being cut out of the Medicaid budget, it will absolutely impact everyone that we work to serve, as well as all of the people that work really hard to support people in the system who are overall a low-income workforce, right? So it'll absolutely have devastating impacts across the state.
And when it comes to state funding, do you think the state is giving you enough in financial resources to support the work that you're doing?
So under this governor, we have had incredible investments over the last 4 years. Governor Hochul's invested $4 billion in new funding just to our service system in the last 4 years by way of cost of living adjustments and workforce bonuses. And the $850 million investment we made recently to our nonprofit provider system. So we have been doing incredibly well in the last few years in my system, really catching up to the cost of doing business and making really intentional investments in places where historically have been underinvested. That being said, with a $14 billion cut to Medicaid coming up, you know, the New York State, no matter how good a financial state we're in, is never going to be able to make up that loss of funding.
And lastly, what are some of your long-term goals for the office? How are you hoping that the state will continue to support people with developmental disabilities in the years to come?
I think we're really on a great track. We have a really robust strategic plan that we've been working on over the last few years that really set out short-term and long-term goals for the agency. You know, like I said, I've been really intentional about involving self-advocates and family advocates and developing better relationships with our nonprofit providers to make sure that they feel very supported and that the direct support staff that work really hard every day across the state to support people feel supported and have the resources to do the job they need to do. So I'm very excited to just continue that work, driving forward our strategic plan, making sure people have what they need to really live integrated lives and to increase the number of people employed. That's an area in New York State where we've historically not done a great job of making sure people with disabilities have access to meaningful employment. So we're very focused on driving that forward this year as well.
That was OPWDD Commissioner Willow Bear speaking with Chantel Destra of the New York Public News Network. You can learn more about the office and its work at opwdd.ny.gov. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The nightmare down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my